foot.
John?
Sarah asks. She's sitting on a large rock with her knees to her chest and her arms wrapped around them. She isn't wearing goggles and squints in our direction.
Yes,
I say. And Sam. She smiles.
Told you,
she says, and I assume she's talking to Mark. The water, I heard, is nothing more than a small babbling brook. Mark steps forward.
Well, well, well,
he says. Shut up, Mark, I say. Manure in my locker was one thing, but you've gone way too far with this one.
You think? It's 8-on-2.
Sam has nothing to do with this. You scared to face me alone? I ask. What are you expecting to happen? You've tried kidnapping 2 people. Do you really think they'll keep silent?
Yeah, I do. When they see me whip your ass.
You're delusional, I say, then turn to the others. For those of you who don't want to go into the water, I suggest you leave now. Mark is going in no matter what. He's lost his chance to barter. All of them snicker. One of them asks what barter means. Now's your last chance, I say. Every one of them stands firm. So be it, I say. A nervous excitement plants itself in the center of my chest. As I take one step forward, Mark steps back and trips over his own feet, falling to the ground. 2 of the guys come at me, both bigger than me. One swings, but I duck his punch and send one of my own into his gut. He doubles over with his hands holding his stomach. I shove the second guy, and his feet leave the ground. He lands with a thud, 5 feet away, and the momentum pushes him into the water. He comes up splashing. The others stand, rooted, shocked. I sense Sam moving over towards Sarah. I grab hold of the first guy and drag him across the ground. His errant kicks slice through the air but hit nothing. When we are at the bank of the brook, I lift him by the waistband of his jeans and throw him into the water. Another guy lunges at me. I merely sidestep him, and he lands face first in the brook. 3 down, 4 to go. I wonder how much of this Sarah and Sam can see without goggles on. You guys are making it too easy for me, I say. Who's next? The biggest of the group throws a punch that comes nowhere near hitting me, though I counter so swiftly that his elbow catches me in the face and the goggle strap snaps. The goggles fall to the ground. I can only see slight shadows now. I throw a punch and hit the guy in the jaw, and he falls to the ground like a sack of potatoes. He looks lifeless, and I fear that I've hit him too hard. I rip his goggles from his face and put them on. Any volunteers? 2 of them hold their hands up in front of them, in surrender. The third stands with his mouth gaping open like an idiot. That leaves you, Mark. Mark turns as though he intends to run, but I lunge forward and grab him before he can, pulling his arms up into a full Nelson. He writhes in pain. This ends right now. Do you understand me? I squeeze tighter, and he grunts in pain. Whatever you have against me, you drop it now. That includes Sam and Sarah. You understand? My grip tightens. I fear that if I squeeze any tighter, his shoulder will pop from its socket.
I said, do you understand me?
Yes!
I drag him over to Sarah. Sam is sitting on the rock beside her now. Apologize.
Come on, man, you've proven your point.
I squeeze.
I'm sorry,
he yells.
Say it like you mean it.
He takes a deep breath.
I'm sorry,
he says.
You're an asshole, Mark,
Sarah says, and slaps him hard across the face. He tenses. But I'm holding him firmly, and there isn't a thing he can do about it. I drag him to the water. The rest of the guys stand watching in shock. The guy I had knocked out He's sitting up, scratching his head as though trying to figure out what has happened. I breathe a sigh of relief that he isn't badly hurt.
You're not going to say a word to anybody about this. You understand me?
I say, my voice so low that only Mark can hear me.
Everything that has happened tonight, it dies here. I swear, if I hear one word about it in school next week, this is nothing compared to what will happen to you. Do you understand me? Not a single word.
Do you really think I would say anything? He asks.
You make sure you tell your friends the same. If they tell a single soul, it will be you that I come for.
We won't say anything, he says.
I let go, put my foot on his butt, and push him face first into the water. Sarah is standing at the rock with Sam beside her. She hugs me tightly when I get to her.
Do you know kung fu or something? She asks.
I laugh nervously. Could you see much?
Not a lot, but I could tell what was happening. I mean, have you been training in the mountains your whole life or what? I don't understand how you did that.
I was just scared something would happen to you, I guess. And, yeah, there was the past 12 years of martial arts training high in the Himalayas.
You're amazing, Sarah laughs. Let's get out of here.
None of the guys say a word to us. After 10 feet, I realize I have no idea where I'm going. So I give the goggles to Sarah to lead the way.
I can't friggin' believe that, Sarah says. I mean, what an asshole.
Wait till they try to explain it to the police. I'm not letting him get away with it. Are you really going to the police? Mark's dad is the sheriff, after all, I say.
Why wouldn't I after that? It was bullshit. Mark's dad's job is to enforce law even when his son breaks it.
I shrug in the darkness. I think they received their punishment. I bite my lip, terrified of the police getting involved. If they do, I'll have to leave. No way around it. We'll be packed up and headed out of town within the hour of Henri knowing. I sigh. Don't you think? I ask. I mean, they've already lost several of the night vision goggles. They'll have to explain that. And that's not to mention the icy cold water. Sarah doesn't say anything. We walk in silence, and I pray that she is debating the merits of letting it go. Eventually, the end of the woods comes into view. Light reaches in from the park. When I stop, Sarah and Sam both look at me. Sam has been silent the entire time, and I'm hoping that it's because he couldn't really see what was happening. The dark for once serving as an unexpected ally, that maybe he's a little shaken up by everything. It's up to you guys, I say, but I'm all for just letting the matter die. I really don't want to have to talk to police about what happened. The light falls on Sarah's skeptical face. She shakes her head.
I think he's right, Sam says. I don't want to have to sit and write a stupid statement for the next half hour. I'll be in deep crap. My mom thinks I went to bed an hour ago.
You live nearby? I ask. He nods.
Yeah, and I gotta go before she checks my room. I'll see you guys around.
Without another word, Sam hurries away. He's clearly rattled. He's probably never been in a fight, and certainly never one where he was kidnapped and attacked in the woods. I'll try talking to him tomorrow. If he did see something he shouldn't have, I'll convince him his eyes were playing tricks on him. Sarah turns my face to hers and traces the line of my cut with her thumb, moving it very gently across my forehead. Then she traces both my brows, staring into my eyes.
Thank you for tonight. I knew you were going to come.
I shrug. I wasn't going to let him scare you. She smiles, and I can see her eyes glistening in the moonlight. She moves towards me, and as I realize what's about to happen, my breath catches in my throat. She presses her lips to mine, and everything inside of me turns to rubber. It's a soft kiss, lingering, my first. Then she pulls away, and her eyes take me in. I don't know what to say.
A million different thoughts run through my head. My legs feel wobbly, and I'm barely able to stay upright.
I knew you were special the first time I saw you, she says. I felt the same with you.
She reaches up and kisses me again, her hand lightly pressed to my cheek. For the first few seconds, I'm lost in the feel of her lips on mine and in the idea that I'm with this beautiful girl. She pulls away, and both of us smile at each other, saying nothing, staring into each other's eyes.
Well, I think we better go see if Emily is still here, Sarah says after about 10 seconds, or else I'll be stranded.
I'm sure she is, I say. We hold hands on the walk to the pavilion. I can't stop thinking about our kisses. The fifth tractor chugs along the trail. The trailer is full, and there's still a line 10 or so people long waiting their turn. And after everything that happened in the woods, with Sarah's warm hand in mine, the smile doesn't leave my face. Chapter 15. The first snowfall comes 2 weeks later. A slight dusting, just enough to cover the truck with a fine powder. Since just after Halloween, once the lauric crystal spread the lumen throughout my body, Henri has begun my real training. We've worked every day, without fail, through the cold weather and the rain, and now the snow. Though he doesn't say it, I believe he's impatient for me to be ready. It started with disconcerted looks, his brows crinkled while he chewed on his bottom lip, followed by deep sighs, and eventually sleepless nights, the floorboards creaking under his feet while I lay awake in my room, to where we are now, an inherent desperation in Henri's strained voice. We stand in the backyard, 10 feet apart, facing each other. I'm not really in the mood today, I say.
I know you're not, but we have to anyway.
I sigh and look at my watch. It's 4 o'clock. Sarah will be here at 6, I say.
I know, Henri says. That's why we must hurry.
He holds a tennis ball in each hand.
Are you ready?
He asks. As ready as I'll ever be. He throws the first ball high in the air, and as it reaches its apex, I try to conjure a power deep within me to keep it from falling. I don't know how I'm supposed to do it. Only that I should be able to do it, with time and practice, says Henri. Each guard develops the ability to move objects with their mind, telekinesis. And instead of letting me discover it on my own, as I did my hands, Henri seems hell-bent on waking the power from whatever cave it's hibernating in. The ball drops just as the 1,000 or so balls before it did, without a single interruption. Bouncing twice, then lying motionless in the snow-covered grass. I let out a deep sigh. I'm not feeling it today.
Again, Henri says.
He throws the second ball. I try to move it, to stop it. Everything inside of me straining to just make the damn thing move a single inch to the right or left, but no luck. It hits the ground as well. Bernie Kosar, who has been watching us, walks out to it, picks it up, and walks away. It'll come in its own time, I say. Henri shakes his head. The muscles in his jaw are flexed. His moods and impatience are getting to me. He watches Bernie Kosar trot off with the ball, then he sighs. What? I ask. He shakes his head again.
Let's keep trying.
He walks over and picks up the other ball. Then he flings it high in the air. I try to stop it, but of course, it just falls. Maybe tomorrow, I say. Henri nods and looks at the ground.
Maybe tomorrow.
I am covered in sweat and mud and melted snow after our workout. Henri pushed me harder than normal today, and came at me with an aggression that could only be steeped in panic. Beyond the telekinesis practice, Most of our session was spent drilling technique in fighting, hand-to-hand combat, wrestling, mixed martial arts, followed by elements of composure, grace under pressure, mind control, how to spot fear in the eyes of an opponent, and then know how to best expose it. It wasn't Henri's hard training that got to me, but rather the look in his eyes. A distressed look, tinged with fear, despair, disappointment. I don't know if he's just concerned about progress, or if it's something deeper, but these sessions are becoming very exhausting, emotionally and physically. Sarah arrives right on time. I walk outside and kiss her as she's coming up to the front porch. I take her coat from her and hang it when we're inside. Our home ec midterm is a week away, and it was her idea to cook the meal before we'll have to prepare it in class. As soon as we begin cooking, Henri grabs his jacket and goes for a walk. He takes Bernie Kosar with him, and I'm thankful for the privacy. We make baked chicken breasts and potatoes and steamed vegetables, and the meal comes out far better than I had hoped. When all is ready, the three of us sit and eat together. Henri is silent through most of it. Sarah and I break the awkward silence with small talk, about school, about our going to the movies the following Saturday. Henri rarely looks up from his plate other than to offer how wonderful the meal is. When dinner is over, Sarah and I wash the dishes and retreat to the couch. Sarah brought a movie over, and we watch it on our small TV, but Henri mostly stares out the window. Halfway through, he gets up with a sigh and walks outside. Sarah and I watch him go. We hold hands and she leans against me with her head on my shoulder. Bernie Kosar sits beside her, with his head in her lap, a blanket draped over both of them. It may be cold and blustery outside, but it's warm and cozy in our living room. "Is your dad okay?" Sarah asks. "I don't know. He's been acting weird." "He was really quiet during dinner." "Yeah. I'm going to go check on him. I'll be right back," I say, and follow Henri outside. He's standing on the porch, looking out into the darkness. "So what's going on?" I ask. He looks up at the stars in contemplation.
"Something doesn't feel right," he says.
"What do you mean?"
"You're not going to like it."
"Okay, let's have it."
"I don't know how much longer we should stay here. It doesn't feel safe to me."
My heart sinks, and I stay silent.
"They're frantic, and I think they're getting close. I can feel it. I don't think we're safe here."
"I don't want to leave."
"I knew you wouldn't."
"We've kept hidden." Henri looks at me with a raised brow.
"No offense, John, but I hardly think you've stayed in the shadows."
"I have where it counts." He nods.
"I guess we'll see."
He walks to the edge of the porch and places his hands on the rail. I stand beside him. New snowflakes start falling, sifting down, specks of white shimmering on an otherwise dark night.
"That's not all,"
Henri says. "I didn't think it was." He sighs.
"You should have already developed telekinesis. It almost always comes with your first legacy. Very rarely does it come after, and when it does, it's never longer than a week later."
I look over at him. His eyes are full of concern, and creases of worry traverse the length of his forehead.
"Your legacies come from Lorien. They always have."
"So what are you telling me?"
"I don't know how much we can expect from here on out," he says, and pauses. "Since we're no longer on the planet, I don't know if the rest of your legacies will come at all. And if that is true, we have no hope of fighting the Mogadorians, much less defeating them. And if we can't defeat them, we'll never be able to go back."
I watch the snow fall, unable to decide whether I should be worried or relieved.
relieved since perhaps that would bring an end to our moving and we could finally settle.
Henri points at the stars. Right there,
he says.
Right there is where Lorien is.
Of course, I know full well where Lorien is without having to be told. There is a certain pull, a certain way that my eyes always gravitate towards the spot where, billions of miles away, Lorien sits. I try to catch a snowflake on the tip of my tongue, then close my eyes and breathe in the cold air. When I open them, I turn around and look at Sarah through the window. She's sitting with her legs beneath her, Bernie Kosar's head still in her lap. Have you ever thought of just settling here? Of saying to hell with Lorien and making a life here on Earth? I ask Henri.
We left when you were pretty young. I don't imagine you remember much of it, do you?
Not really, I say. Bits and pieces come to me from time to time, though I can't necessarily say whether they are things I remember or things I've seen during our training.
I don't think you would feel that way if you could remember.
But I don't remember. Isn't that the point?
Maybe,
he says.
But whether or not you want to go back doesn't mean the Mogadorians are going to stop searching for you. And if we get careless and settle, you can be assured they'll find us. And as soon as they do, they'll kill us both. There's no way to change that. No way.
I know he's right. Somehow, like Henri, I can sense that much. Can feel it in the dead of night when the hairs on my arms stand at attention. When a slight shiver crawls up my spine even though I'm not cold. Do you ever regret sticking with me for this long?
Regret it? Why do you think I would regret it?
Because there's nothing for us to go back to? Your family is dead. So is mine. On Lorien there is only a life of rebuilding. If it wasn't for me, you could easily create an identity here and spend the rest of your days becoming a part of some place. You could have friends, maybe even fall in love again.
Henri laughs.
I'm already in love, and I'll continue to be until the day that I die. I don't expect you to understand that. Lorien is different from Earth.
I sigh with exasperation. But still, you could be a part of somewhere.
I am a part of somewhere. I'm a part of Paradise, Ohio, right now, with you.
I shake my head. You know what I mean, Henri.
What is it you think I'm missing?
A life?
You are my life, kiddo. You and my memories are my only ties to the past. Without you, I have nothing. That's the truth.
Just then the door opens behind us. Bernie Kosar comes trotting out ahead of Sarah, who is standing in the doorway, half in and half out. Are you two really going to make me watch this movie all by my lonesome? She asks. Henri smiles at her.
Wouldn't dream of it,
he says. After the movie, Henri and I drive Sarah home. When we get there, I walk her to her front door, and we stand on the stoop, smiling at each other. I kiss her goodnight, a lingering kiss, while holding both her hands gently in mine. See you tomorrow, she says, giving my hands a squeeze. Sweet dreams. I walk back to the truck. Henri pulls out of Sarah's driveway and steers towards home. I can't help feeling a sense of fear while remembering Henri's words the day he picked me up for my first full day of school.
Just keep in mind, we might have to leave at a moment's notice.
He's right, and I know it, but I've never felt this way about anyone before. Like I'm floating on air when we're together, and I dread the times when we're apart. Like now, despite having just spent the last couple of hours with her. Sarah gives some purpose to our running and hiding, a reason that transcends mere survival, a reason to win.
And to know that I may be putting her life in danger by being with her, well, it terrifies me. When we get back, Henri walks into his bedroom and comes out carrying the chest. He drops it on the kitchen table. Really? I ask. He nods.
There's something in here I've wanted to show you for years.
I can't wait to see what else is in the chest. We pop the lock together, and he lifts the lid in such a way that I can't peer in. Henri removes a velvet bag, closes the chest, and relocks it.
These aren't part of your legacy, but the last time we opened the chest, I slipped them in, because of the bad feeling I've been having. If the Mogadorians catch us, they'll never be able to open this,
he says, and motions to the chest. So what's in the bag?
The solar system,
he says. If they aren't part of my legacy, then why have you never shown me?
Because you needed to develop a legacy in order to activate them.
He clears the kitchen table and then sits across from me with the bag in his lap. He smiles at me, sensing my enthusiasm. Then he reaches down and removes 7 glass orbs of varying sizes from the bag. He holds them up to his face in his cupped hands and blows on the glass orbs. Tiny flickers of light come from within them. Then he tosses them up in the air, and all at once, they come to life, suspended above the kitchen table. The glass balls are a replica of our solar system. The largest of them is the size of an orange, Lorien's sun, and it hangs in the middle, emitting the same amount of light as a light bulb, while looking like a self-contained sphere of lava. The other balls orbit around it. Those closest to the sun move at a faster rate, while those farthest away seem to only creep by. All of them spinning, days beginning and ending at hyperspeed. The fourth globe from the sun is Lorien. We watch it move, watch the surface of it begin to form. It is about the size of a racquetball. The replica must not be to scale, because in reality, Lorien is far smaller than our sun. So what's happening? I ask.
The ball is taking on the exact form of what Lorien looks like at this moment.
How is this even possible?
It's a special place, John. An old magic exists at its very core. That's where your legacies come from. It's what gives life and reality to the objects contained within your inheritance.
But you just said that this isn't part of my legacy.
No, but they come from the same place.
Indentations form, mountains grow. Deep creases cut across the surface where I know rivers once ran. And then it stops. I look for any sort of color, any movement, any wind that might blow across the land, but there is nothing. The entire landscape is a monochromatic patch of gray and black. I don't know what I had hoped to see, what I had expected. Movement of some kind, a hint of fertileness? My spirits fall. Then the surface dims away so that we can see through it. And at the very core of the globe, a slight glow begins to form. It glows, then dims, then glows again, as though replicating the heartbeat of a sleeping animal. What is that? I ask.
The planet still lives and breathes. It has withdrawn deep into itself, biding its time, hibernating, if you will. But it will wake one of these days.
What makes you so sure?
That little glow right there,
he says.
That is hope, John.
I watch it. I find an odd pleasure in seeing it glow. They tried to wipe away our civilization, the planet itself, and yet it still breathes. Yes, I think. There is always hope, just as Henri has said all along.
That isn't all.
Henri stands and snaps his fingers, and the planets stop moving. He moves his face to within inches of Lorien, then cups his hands around his mouth and again breathes onto it. Hints of green and blue sweep across the ball and begin to fade almost immediately as the mist from Henri's breath evaporates. What did you do?
Flash your hands on it, he says.
I make them glow, and when I hold them over the ball, the green and blue come back. Only this time, they stay, as my hands shine upon it.
It's how Lorien looked the day before the invasion. Would you look how beautiful it all is? Sometimes, even I forget.
It is beautiful. Everything green and blue, plush and verdant. The vegetation seems to waver beneath gusts of wind that I can somehow feel. Slight ripples appear on the water. The planet is truly alive, flourishing. But then I turn my glow back off, and it all fades away, back to shades of gray. Henri points at a spot on the globe's surface.
Right here, he says, is where we took off from the day of the invasion.
Then he moves his finger half an inch from the spot.
And right here is where the Lorik Museum of Exploration used to be.
I nod and look at the spot he's pointing to. More gray. What do museums have to do with anything? I ask. I sit back in the chair. It's hard to look at this without feeling sad. He looks back at me.
I've been thinking a lot about what you saw.
Uh-huh, I say, urging him on.
It was a huge museum, devoted entirely to the evolution of space travel. One of the wings of the building held early rockets that were thousands of years old. Rockets that used to run on a kind of fuel known only to Lorien,
he says, and stops, looking back to the small glass orb hanging 2 feet above our kitchen table.
Now, if what you saw did in fact happen, if a second ship managed to take off and escape from Lorien during the height of the war, then it would have to have been housed at the Space Museum. There's no other explanation for it. I'm still having a tough time believing that it would have worked, and even if it did, that it would have gotten very far.
So if it wouldn't have gotten very far, then why are you still thinking about it? Henri shakes his head.
You know, I'm not really sure. Maybe because I've been wrong before. Maybe because I'm hoping I am wrong now. And, well, if it had made it anywhere, then it would have made it here, the closest life-sustaining planet aside from Mogador. And that's to assume that there was life on it in the first place, that it wasn't just full of artifacts, or that it wasn't just empty, meant to confuse the Mogadorians. But I think there had to have been at least one Lorik manning the ship because, well, as I'm sure you know, ships of that nature couldn't steer themselves.
Another night of insomnia. I stand shirtless in front of the mirror, staring into it with both lights and my hands turned on.
I don't know how much we can expect from here on out, Henri said today.
The light at Lorien's core still burns, and the objects we brought from there still work. So why would that magic have ended there? And what about the others? Are they now running into the same problems? Are they without their legacies? I flex in front of the mirror, then punch the air, hoping that the mirror will break or a thud will be heard on the door. But there is nothing. Just me looking like an idiot standing shirtless, shadowboxing with myself, while Bernie Kosar watches from the bed. It's nearly midnight, and I'm not tired in the least. Bernie Kosar jumps off the bed, sits beside me, and watches my reflection. I smile at him, and he wags his tail. How about you? I ask Bernie Kosar. Do you have any special powers?
Are you a super dog? Should I put your cape back on so you can go flying through the air?
His tail keeps wagging, and he paws the ground while looking at me through the tops of his eyes. I lift him up and over my head and fly him around the room.
Look, it's Bernie Kosar, the magnificent super dog!
He squirms under my grip, so I set him down. He plops on his side with his tail thumping against the mattress.
Well, buddy, one of us should have superpowers, and it doesn't look like it's going to be me. Unless we go back to the Dark Ages and I can supply the world with light. Otherwise, I'm afraid I'm useless.
Bernie Kosar rolls onto his back and stares at me with big eyes, wanting me to rub his belly. Chapter 16. Sam is avoiding me. At school, he seems to disappear when he sees me, or always makes sure we're in a group. At the urging of Henri, who's desperate to get his hands on Sam's magazine, after combing through everything that came up on the internet and finding nothing like Sam's magazine, I decide to just go over to his place unannounced. Henri drops me off after we've trained for the day. Sam lives on the outskirts of paradise in a small, modest house. There's no answer when I knock, so I try the door. It's unlocked, and I open it and walk through. Brown shag carpet covers the floors, and family photographs from when Sam was very young hang on wood-paneled walls. Him, his mother, and a man who I assume is his father, who is wearing glasses every bit as thick as Sam's. Then I look closer. They look like the exact same pair of glasses. I creep down the hallway until I find the door that must belong to Sam's bedroom. A sign reading, "Enter at your own risk," hangs from a tack. The door is open a crack and I peer inside. The room is very clean. Everything consciously put in a place. His twin bed is made, has a black comforter with the planet Saturn repeated across it, matching pillowcases. The walls are covered with posters. There are two NASA ones, the movie poster from Alien, a movie poster from Star Wars, and one that is a black light poster of a green alien head surrounded by dark felt. In the center of the room, hanging from clear thread, is the solar system. All 9 planets and the sun. It makes me think of what Henri showed me earlier in the week. I think that Sam would lose his mind if he were to see the same thing. And then I see Sam, hunched over a small oak desk with headphones on. I push the door open, and he looks over his shoulder. He isn't wearing his glasses, and without them, his eyes look very small and beady, almost cartoon-like. "What's up?" I ask casually, as if I'm at his house every day. He looks shocked and scared, and he frantically pulls the headphones off to reach in one of the drawers. I look at his desk and see that he's reading a copy of They Walk Among Us. When I look back up, he is pointing a gun at me. "Whoa," I say, instinctively lifting my hands in front of me. "What's going on?" He stands up. His hands are shaking. The gun is pointed at my chest. I think that he's lost his mind.
"Tell me what you are," he says.
"What are you talking about?"
"I saw what you did in those woods. You're not human."
I was afraid of this, that he saw more than I had hoped.
"This is crazy, Sam. I got into a fight. I've been doing martial arts for years."
"Your hands lit up like flashlights. You could throw people around like they were nothing. That's not normal."
"Don't be stupid," I say, my hands still in front of me. "Look at them. Do you see any lights?"
"I told you, they were gloves that Kevin was wearing." "I asked Kevin. He said he wasn't wearing gloves."
"Do you think he would tell you the truth after what happened? Put the gun down."
"Tell me, what are you?"
I roll my eyes. "Yes, I'm an alien, Sam. I'm from a planet hundreds of millions of miles away. I have superpowers. Is that what you want to hear?" He stares at me, his hands still shaking.
"Do you realize how stupid that sounds? Quit being crazy and put the gun down."
Is what you just said true?
That you're being stupid?
Yes, it's true.
You're too obsessed with this stuff. You see aliens and alien conspiracies in every part of your life, including in your only friend. Now quit pointing that damn gun at me.
He stares at me, and I can tell he's thinking about what I said. I drop my hands. Then he sighs and lowers the gun.
I'm sorry, he says.
I take a deep, nervous breath.
You should be. What the hell were you thinking?
It wasn't actually loaded.
You should have told me that earlier, I say.
Why do you want so badly to believe in this stuff?
He shakes his head and puts the gun back in the drawer. I take a minute to calm myself down and try to act casual, like what just happened is no big deal. What are you reading? I ask. He shrugs.
Just more alien stuff. Maybe I should cool it a bit.
Or just read it as fiction instead of fact, I say. The stuff must be pretty convincing, though. Can I see it? He hands me the latest copy of They Walk Among Us, and I sit tentatively on the edge of his bed. I think he's calmed down enough to not spring a gun on me again, at least. Again, it is a bad photocopy. The print slightly unaligned with the paper. It isn't very thick. 8 pages. 12 at the most. Printed on legal-sized sheets. The date at the top reads, December. It must be the newest issue.
This is weird stuff, Sam Good, I say.
He smiles.
Weird people like weird stuff.
Where do you get this? I ask.
I subscribe to it.
I know, but how? Sam shrugs.
I don't know. It just started arriving one day.
Are you subscribed to some other magazine? Perhaps they pulled your contact info from there.
I went to a convention once. I think I signed up for some contest or something while I was there. I can't remember. I've always assumed that's where they got my address.
I scan the cover. There's no website listed anywhere on it, and I didn't expect there to be, considering that Henri has already searched the internet high and low. I read the headline of the top story. Is your neighbor an alien? 10 fail-safe ways to tell. In the middle of the article, there's a picture of a man holding a bag of trash in one hand and the lid to the trash can in the other. He is standing at the end of the driveway, and we're to assume he's in the process of dropping the bag into the can. Though the whole publication is in black and white, there is a certain glow to the man's eyes. It's a horrible image, as though somebody took a picture of an unsuspecting neighbor and then drew around his eyes with a crayon. It makes me laugh.
What?
Sam asks. This is a terrible picture. It looks like something from Godzilla. Sam looks at it, then he shrugs.
I don't know, he says. It could be real. Like you said, I see aliens everywhere and in everything.
But I thought aliens looked like that, I say, and nod to the black light poster on his wall.
I don't think all of them do, he says. Like you said, you're an alien with superpowers and you don't look like that.
We both laugh, and I wonder how I'm going to get myself out of that one. Hopefully, Sam never finds out I was telling him the truth. Part of me wants to tell him, though, about me, about Henri, about Lorian, and I wonder what his reaction would be. Would he believe me? I flip the paper open to look for the publishing page that all newspapers and magazines have. There isn't one here. Only more stories and theories. There isn't a publisher info page.
What do you mean?
You know how magazines and newspapers always have that page listing staff, editors, writers, where it's being printed and all that? You know, for questions, contact so-and-so. All publications have them, but this doesn't.
They have to protect their anonymity, Sam says.
From what?
Aliens,
he says, and smiles as though acknowledging the absurdity of it. Do you have last month's issue? He grabs it from his closet. I quickly flip through it, hoping that the Mogadorian article is in this one and not an earlier month. And then I find it on page 4.
The Mogadorian race seek to take over Earth. The Mogadorian alien race from the planet Mogador of the Ninth Galaxy have been on Earth for over 10 years now. They're a vicious race on a quest for universal domination. They are rumored to have wiped out another planet not unlike Earth, and are planning to expose Earth's weaknesses in a quest to inhabit our planet next. More to follow next issue. I read the article 3 times. I was hoping there might be more to it than what Sam already said, but no such luck. And there is no Ninth Galaxy. I wonder where they got that from. I flipped through the new issue 2 times. There is no mention of the Mogadorians. My first thought is that there was nothing left to report, that more news failed to present itself. But I don't believe that's the case. My second thought is that the Mogadorians read the issue and then fixed the problem, whatever the problem was. "Do you mind if I borrow this?" I ask, holding up last month's issue. He nods.
"But be careful with it."
3 hours later, at 8 o'clock, Sam's mother still isn't home. I ask Sam where she is, and he shrugs as though he doesn't know and her absence is nothing new. Mostly, we just play video games and watch TV, and for dinner, we eat microwavable meals. The whole time I'm there, he doesn't once wear his glasses, which is odd, since I've never seen him without them before. Even when we ran the mile in gym class, he kept them on. I grab them from the top of his dresser and put them on. The world becomes an instant blur, and they give me a headache almost immediately. I look at Sam. He's sitting cross-legged on the floor, his back against his bed, with a book of aliens in his lap. "Jesus, is your vision really this bad?" I ask. He looks up at me.
"They were my dad's."
I take them off. "Do you even need glasses, Sam?" He shrugs.
"Not really."
"So why do you wear them?"
"They were my dad's."
I put them back on.
"Wow, I don't see how you can even walk straight with these on."
"My eyes are used to them."
"You know these will screw up your vision if you continue wearing them, right?"
"Then I'll be able to see what my dad saw."
I take them off and put them back where I found them. I don't really understand why Sam wears them. For sentimental reasons? Does he really think it's worth it? "Where is your dad, Sam?" He looks up at me.
"I don't know," he says.
"What do you mean?"
"He disappeared when I was 7.
"You don't know where he went?" He sighs, drops his head, and resumes reading. Obviously, he doesn't want to talk about it.
"Do you believe in any of this stuff?"
he asks after a few minutes of silence.
"Aliens?"
"Yeah." "Yes, I believe in aliens."
"Do you think they really abduct people?"
"I have no idea. I guess we can't rule it out. Do you believe they do?" He nods.
"Most days. But sometimes the idea just seems stupid."
"I can understand that." He looks up at me.
"I think my dad was abducted," he says.
He tenses the second the words leave his mouth, and a look of vulnerability crosses his face. It makes me believe that he has shared his theory before with someone whose response was less than kind. "Why do you think that?"
"Because he just disappeared. He went to the store to buy milk and bread, and he never came back. His truck was parked right outside the store, but nobody there had seen him. He just vanished. And his glasses were on the sidewalk beside his truck."
He pauses for a second.
"I was worried you were here to abduct me."
It's a hard theory to believe. How could nobody have seen his father abducted if the incident occurred in the middle of town? Perhaps his dad had reason to leave and he plotted his own disappearance. It's not hard to make yourself disappear. Henri and I have been doing it for 10 years now. But all of a sudden, Sam's interest in aliens makes perfect sense. Perhaps Sam just wants to see the world as his dad did. But maybe part of him truly believes that his dad's final sight is captured in the glasses, somehow etched into the lenses. Maybe he thinks that, with persistence, one day he'll eventually come to see it as well, and that his dad's last vision will confirm what is already in his head. Or maybe he believes that if he searches long enough, he'll finally come across an article that proves his father was abducted, and not only that, but that he can be saved. And who am I to say that he won't one day find that proof? I believe you, I say. I think alien abductions are very possible. Chapter 17. The next day I wake earlier than normal, crawl out of bed, and walk out of my room to find Henri sitting at the table, scanning the papers with his laptop open. The sun is still hidden, and the house is dark. The only light coming from his computer screen. Anything?
Nah, nothing really.
I turn on the kitchen light. Bernie Kosar paws at the front door. I open it, and he shoots out into the yard and patrols as he does every morning, heads up, trotting around the perimeter, looking for anything suspicious. He sniffs at random places. Once satisfied that everything is as it should be, he bolts into the woods and disappears. Two issues of They Walk Among Us are lying atop the kitchen table. The original, and a photocopy that Henri has made to keep for himself. A magnifying glass lies between them. Anything unique on the original?
No.
So now what? I ask.
Well, I have had some luck. I cross-referenced some of the other articles in the issue and got a few hits, one of which led me to a man's personal website. I sent him an email.
I stare at Henri.
Don't worry, he says. They can't track emails, at least not the way I send them.
How do you send them?
I reroute them through various servers in cities across the world, so that the original location is lost along the way.
Impressive. Bernie Kosar scratches at the door, and I let him in. The clock on the microwave reads 5:59. I have 2 hours before I have to be at school. Do you really think we want to go digging around in all this? I ask. I mean, what if it's all a trap? What if they are simply trying to root us out of hiding? Henri nods.
You know, if the article had mentioned anything about us, that might have given me pause. But it didn't. It was about their invading Earth, much the same way they did Lorien. There is so much about it that we don't understand. You were right a few weeks ago when you said we were defeated so easily. We were. It doesn't make sense. The entire situation with the disappearance of the elders also doesn't make sense. Even getting you and the other children off of Lorien, which I have never questioned, seems odd. And while you've seen what happened, and I've had the same visions too, something is still missing from the equation. If we one day make it back, I think it's imperative to understand what happened in order to prevent it from happening again. You know the saying, he who doesn't understand history is doomed to repeat it. And when it's repeated, the stakes are doubled.
Okay, I say. But according to what you said Saturday night, the chance of us going back seems slimmer every day. So with that, do you think it's worth it? Henri shrugs.
There are still 5 others out there. Perhaps they've received their legacies. Perhaps yours are merely delayed. I think it's best to plan for all possibilities.
Well, what are you planning to do?
Just make a phone call. I'm curious to hear what this person knows. I wonder what caused him to not follow up. One of 2 possibilities. Either he found no other information and lost interest in the story, or somebody got to him after the publication.
I sigh. Well, be careful, I say.
I pull on a pair of sweatpants and a sweatshirt over two t-shirts, tie my tennis shoes, and stand and stretch. I toss into my backpack the clothes I plan to wear to school, along with a towel, a bar of soap, and a small bottle of shampoo so I can shower when I get there. I'll now be running to school each morning. Henri ostensibly believes the additional exercise will help in my training, but the real reason is that he hopes it will help my body's transition and pull my legacies from their slumber, if that is indeed what they are doing. I look down at Bernie Kosar. Ready for a run, boy? Huh? Want to go for a run? His tail wags, and he turns in circles. See you after school.
Have a good run, says Henri. Be careful on the road.
We walk out the door, and cold, brisk air meets us. Bernie Kosar barks excitedly a few times. I start at a slight jog, down the drive, out onto the gravel road, the dog trotting beside me as I thought he would. It takes a quarter mile to warm up. Ready to step it up a notch, boy? He pays me no attention, just keeps trotting along with his tongue dangling, looking happy as can be. All right then, here we go. I kick it into high gear, moving into a run, and then into a dead sprint shortly after, going as fast as I can. I leave Bernie Kosar in the dust. I look behind me, and he is running as fast as he can, yet I am pulling ahead of him. The wind through my hair, the trees passing in a blur, it all feels great. Then Bernie Kosar bolts into the woods and disappears from sight. I'm not sure if I should stop and wait for him. Then I turn around, and Bernie Kosar jumps out of the woods 10 feet in front of me. I look down at him, and he looks up at me, tongue to the side, a sense of glee in his eyes. You're an odd dog, you know that? After 5 minutes, the school comes into view. I sprint the remaining half mile, exerting myself, running as hard as I can, because it is so early that there is no one out and about to see me. Then I stand with my fingers interlocked behind my head, catching my breath. Bernie Kosar arrives 30 seconds later and sits watching me. I kneel down and pet him. Good job, buddy. I think we have a new morning ritual. I pull my bag from over my shoulders, unzip it, and remove a package with a few strips of bacon, and I give them to him. He scarfs them down. Okay, boy, I'm heading in. Go on home. Henri's waiting. He watches me for a second, then goes off trotting towards home. His comprehension completely amazes me. Then I turn and walk into the building and head for the shower. I am the second person to enter astronomy. Sam is the first, already sitting in his normal seat at the back of the class. Whoa, I say. No glasses. What gives? He shrugs.
I thought about what you said. It's probably stupid for me to wear them.
I sit beside him and smile. It's hard to imagine I'll ever get used to his eyes looking so beady. I give him back the issue of They Walk Among Us. He tucks it into his bag. I hold up my fingers like a gun and nudge him. Bang, I say. He starts laughing. Then I do too. Neither of us can stop. Every time one of us is close, the other starts laughing, and it begins all over again. People stare at us when they enter. Then comes Sarah. She walks in by herself, saunters up to us with a look of confusion, and sits in the seat beside me. What are you guys laughing at? I'm not really sure, I say, and then laugh a little more. Mark is the last person to walk in. He sits in his usual seat, but instead of Sarah sitting beside him today, there's another girl. I think she's a senior. Sarah reaches beneath the table and grabs hold of my hand. There is something I need to talk to you about, she says. What? I know it's last minute, but my parents want to have you and your dad over for Thanksgiving dinner tomorrow. Wow, that would be awesome. I have to ask, but I know we don't have plans, so I assume the answer is yes. She smiles. Great. Since it's just the two of us, we don't usually even do Thanksgiving. Well, we really go all out, and and my brothers will both be home from college. They want to meet you. How do they know about me? How do you think? The teacher walks in and Sarah winks. Then we both start taking